As I said before, I'm Joanne Hepworth, and I am a religious science practitioner. And I am excited to be here. I am in a place where consciousness is a constant pursuit. And I'm delighted that I have the time and space and location and teachers that allow me to expand my consciousness into at least frequent presence, a frequent conscious awareness of the presence. I wish it was always, but we're working on it. And my life in the country is just a blessing that I could never have imagined. I live in West Virginia on the Cacapon River in a beautiful space, and I'm just blessed with so much rich nature and so much love. I have two little dogs that are just amazing bundles of love, and a husband who's very loving and not terribly well, but not terribly sick either. So that's a good thing. It's a good thing he's not terribly sick. But I'm living a life of love and a life of pursuing an active practitioner practice. And how that looks and how I define that is in process. So anyway, I was happy to discover that this chapter, and I guess you all have been working on this,
the whole book,
Earnest, Essential Earnest, which is fabulous. And I guess I wanted to start this talk by reading, if this is okay, the What I Believe section of Earnest, because I think it helps to understand Earnest pretty well. So here I'm going to read it. What I Believe. First, I believe that God is a universal spirit. And by spirit, I mean the life essence of all that is. That subtle and intelligent power which permeates all things and which in each individual is conscious mind. I believe that God is universal spirit, present in every place, conscious in every part, the intelligence and mind of all that is. I believe that humankind is the direct representative of this divine presence on this planet of existence. I believe that the relationship between God and the individual is a direct one, and that the avenue through which the spirit expresses itself to us is through our mind. Our ability to think, to know, and to act are direct channels through which the universal spirit flows. It does not seem necessary to me that we approach God through any formula or intermediary, but rather that the spirit of God, the eternal mind, is the power by which we think and know. It is self-evident that the only God we can know is the God our consciousness perceives. But some will say that while it is true that we cannot think outside ourselves, we can know of that which is outside of ourselves, of the self. This is true, as is the fact that we have a city hall, but it would have no reality to me unless I was aware of its existence. This is true of everything, and while the possibility of knowledge may and must expand, we are ignorant of that which we do not perceive. Therefore, I believe that God is to each one what that person is to God. The divine nature must be infinite, but we know only as much of this nature as we embody. In no other way can God be known to us. I believe the relationship between God and humankind is hidden within, and when we discover a new truth or have a better understanding about the old truth, it is really more of this infinite mind revealing itself through us. I believe in direct communication between spirit and the individual. The universal spirit personifying itself through each and all is a beautiful, illogical, and unavoidable conclusion. This makes of the human a divine being, a personification of the spirit. But if we are divine beings, why is it that we are so limited and forlorn, so poor, miserable, and unhappy? The answer is that we are ignorant of our own nature. And ignorance of the law excuses no one from its effects. I believe that all things are governed by immutable and exact laws. These laws cannot be changed or violated. Our ignorance of them will offer no excuse for their infringement, and we are made to suffer not because God wills it, but because we are ignorant of the truth of our being. We are individuals and have free will and free choice. We shall learn to experience things mental and physical. There is no other way to learn. God himself could not provide any other way without contradicting his own nature. The spirit is subject to the law of its own nature. So are we. I do not believe in hell, devil, or damnation, in any future state of punishment, or of any strange ideas which have been conceived in the minds of morbid people. God does not punish people. It is one thing to believe in hell and damnation, and quite another proposition to believe in the law of just retribution. I am sure that full and complete salvation will come at last alike to all. Heaven and hell are the states of consciousness in which we now live according to our own state of being. We need worry neither about reward or punishment, for both are certain. Eventually, all will be saved from themselves through their own experiences. This is the only salvation necessary and the only one that could be intelligent. I believe in every religion that exists, for it is the avenue through which people worship God. I believe that my own religion, more than that of anyone else, because it is the avenue through which I worship God. I do not believe that there is anything in the universe which is against us, but ourselves. Everything is and must be for us. And God, and only God who exists, and the only God who exists, the Ancient of Days, wishes us well, knows us only as being perfect and complete. When we shall learn to know as God knows, we shall have saved all. We shall be saved from all mistakes and trouble. This is heaven. I believe that we are surrounded by an intelligent law which receives the impress of our thought and acts upon it. This is the law of our life, and we may use it consciously and for definite purposes. I am not superstitious about this law any more than I would be about the law of electricity or any other natural law, for nature is always natural. I believe in a religion of happiness and joy. There is too much depression, sorrow in the world. These things are never meant to be and have no real place in the world of reality. Religion should be like morning sun, sending forth its rays of light. It should feel like falling dew covering the land with fragrance and sweetness. Like the cool of the evening and the repose of night, it should be a spontaneous song of joy and not a funeral dirge. From the fullness of the joyous heart and mouth, the mouth should speak. I believe in the brotherhood of humanity, the parenthood of God, and the unity binding all together in one perfect whole. I believe the spirit is in the wind and the wave and manifests his presence throughout all nature. But most completely through our own minds, our own hearts, it proclaims our livingness and its lovingness.
Beautiful.
So it is.
What page is that?
That's page 28 through 30. So. So anyway, it was interesting to me to also to discover in the beginning of this part of the book, there's a great little foreword, and part of it says that, and this explains a lot about the science of mind, I think, in earnest, is that this was a quote from, anyway, somebody quoted this, then Ernest said this, and it went like this. In this amazing century, bursting away from so much that was slow-paced and orderly in the past, the breakthrough in the physical sciences robbed many people of the cherished religious concepts and left them forlorn. But man is a religious being, and there are thousands who are seeking a philosophy which can be reconciled to their own expanding awareness of the universe, a faith that will square with the century. Which was his purpose. I mean, his purpose in creating the religious science was to help people who had been embroiled in the idea of a deity that was in charge of everything, to understand that science was not a refutation of that, but just a recognition of that, and that with all the scientific discoveries and all the awareness of the body, awareness of physics, awareness that was coming so rapidly in the 20th century, that he wanted to create a space where people could accept science and still understand that universal spirit is in fact real. So anyway, that's good, and that's a lot about what this whole chapter is about. The whole chapter is a little bit disjointed in a way, because the first part is about practitioners and about the method of prayer and the method of being a practitioner, and it explains in the first page that that Ernest Holmes thought of practitioners in two ways. One was the practitioner who's been trained and works in the treatment field, and also, but the practitioner is also everyone. All people everywhere are perfectly endowed with the ability to connect with spirit and do affirmative prayer and to create demonstrations, and he was talking to them as well. So to some degree, the language in this chapter is talking to the professional practitioners, but it's also talking to everyone. So, and I think the first thing that struck me was how clearly the explanation of what our prayer is and how it is. And so I have a few passages that were very helpful to me in understanding that. So I'll read a few. First is, when we treat, we do not wish, we know. We do not dream, we state. We do not pray, we announce. We do not expect something is going to happen, we believe that it has already happened. What must be felt in spiritual practice? What must be felt is the essence of life, the spirit of the thing from which the mind automatically draws an intellectual conclusion. This strong feeling, the feeling of the truth of what we are practicing, this truth of the essence of spirit life, the spirit within, this is the essence of the practitioner, and it needs to be strong and complete conviction to the extent possible. And the truth is all there is. The words that we speak are the enforcement of allness. We must feel the allness of the treatment, not as a mental suggestion, but as a spiritual realization. And there's a difference between holding thoughts and holding things in thought. To hold thoughts is as though we were forcing issues, does no good, and utilizes but a fraction of the creative power at our disposal. We hold a thought, hold in thought, as though we were letting something happen, is to use the great power, the greatest power of all. Now, I want to make clear that anytime anybody wants to jump in and talk about something that I'm saying, I would be really great. I mean, and feel free.
Can you repeat that about the difference in holding thought?
Sure. This is on page 145. And there's a vast difference between holding thoughts and holding things in thought. One is the attempt at an impossible coercion. The other is a mental acceptance. To hold thoughts is to it as though we are forcing issues, does no good, and utilizes but a fraction of the creative power at our disposal. To hold in thought as though we are letting something happen is to use the greater power, the greatest power of all. Is that clear?
Better hearing it,
I mean, I think it's the allowing. I mean, we are not making anything. We are not creating. Well, we are creating, but we're not forcing anything to happen in treatment. What we're doing is realizing the truth of what is. And in that way, when you hold the thought of the truth, then you're allowing it to manifest, as opposed to thinking, this person has to get a job, you know, and then trying to make that happen. That's not how it works. Which is important distinction, because, and it's not one that's always, I'm always aware of either, because there's a lot of times I go, I gotta make this happen, And the truth is that it's a matter of getting in touch with the reality and letting it unfold in the perfect way it has to. Okay. All right, so the next part is here's healing is not creating a perfect idea or a perfect body. It is revealing the idea which is already perfect. Healing is not a process, it is a revelation. Through the thought of the practitioner to the thought of the patient. The premise upon which all mental work is based is perfect God, perfect man, and perfect being. It is the practitioner's business to uncover God in every man. It is God. God is not sick, God is not poor, God is not unhappy, God is never afraid, God is never confused. God is never out of his place. Okay. The next passages reinforce the treatment is done within the mind of the practitioner and expressed silently or verbally. It is not something done to the person requesting it. Well, I guess everyone's familiar with the steps of treatment. The first is a recognition, which is recognizing that all is one, God is all there is, and that truth is everything, everywhere. And the unification is to recognize our oneness with God, with the truth, and with all there is. The third is the realization step, which is where we reveal the truth regarding the situation that we're asked to provide prayer. And fourth is Thanksgiving, and finally the release. And in the silence of our conscious, of our own consciousness, alone with the reality, you balance the account. Not in the other person's mind to see whether he should be an alcoholic or consumptive, but in your own mind to see whether or not you have true love and givingness, and more conviction to bring to bear, not to influence the law, but to be operated upon by the law, with a mathematical and mechanical certainty, at the level of our own conviction. If you cannot depend on the law with mathematical and mechanical certainty, then you have to wait for the moment of inspiration. The practitioner loves his patient back into his own center. With the technical knowledge of practice, he removes the blocks which obstruct the passage of spirit in the patient's experience. He merely makes him by takes he the practitioner takes the patient by the mental hand and leads him back into himself. His entire effort, whether it is audible explanation or spiritual practice, is to establish the patient in his own spiritual center. Spiritual mind practice is a combination of mental technique and spiritual consciousness, which establishes a faith that a conviction, faith and a conviction in the reality of good. Now, this is such a great explanation of what it is that we do and what we're about and what the nature of our work is, and it's so clear that how we can be of help is to be able to see where the client doesn't see the limited beliefs that are holding them back, or the mistakes that they're making in their thinking, or the sometimes it's not that easy. Sometimes you just have to sort of sit back and just know their perfection and see how it is that can be revealed. But the point that what we're doing is not changing them, but helping them to see how to change or how to reveal the truth. And in consciousness, I think it's very important that we realize that when we speak of any of this, it's out of the consciousness of oneness, in the consciousness of the presence, in the consciousness of the connection between spirit, and that through that connection, through the spiritual path, we connect with spirit, and spirit guides us through all of it. And there's nothing I do. It's only through the consciousness of the capital I that I can be of any service, and that I can have any power. So, and on page 146, we have, there can be no permanent healing. Oh, this is so good. There can be no permanent healing without a spiritualization of consciousness. A permanent healing takes place in such degree as consciousness turns inward to the source of being and finds itself united with life, with love, with God. Oh, so good. That's so good. The patient must be shown that he has personal and immediate access to all the presence and all the power there is in the universe. A practitioner's work is good only when he has grounded his patient firmly in a consciousness of his own personal conscious reality. And it's always uncomfortable for me to read the masculine. I try to change it up sometimes, but it's too confusing. But it, suffice it to say that this was the convention of the time. It had nothing to do with male or female. Okay. Then since this mind is functioning in the universal mind in which each individual mind functions, the realization will rise to fulfillment in the one desiring help. In the one desiring help according to his receptivity. Now I think that this particular sentence explains the title of the chapter. Nowhere in the chapter did I find those words, by the way. I don't know if I missed it, but I kept looking and I was like, it's not here. But I do believe that this is the idea that the one mind is the universal mind. And in the universal mind, what is known there is known everywhere, I think. But anyway. the other thing that's good. How do we know when we've treated a patient long enough? How would you know when to stop seeing him if he were a doctor? Oh, this is the practitioner. When he is well, he needs no more treatment. Until this time comes, treat every day for a realization of perfection. Begin each treatment as if you never treated the patient before, trying to realize each time that this particular treatment is going to do the work perfectly. And this is then, next is a bit about abundance. And I think this is good. Ernest believed that abundance to be available to anyone through a newfound acceptance made in consciousness. Suppose I do not say I am poor, but that I came into the world with an unconscious thought of poverty. So long as this thought remains, I am likely to remain poor. I may not understand the law, but it will be working all the time. We come to this world with a subjective tendency towards conditions, but we must not forget that we are dealing with a subjective tendency towards ultimate good. Because in spite of all conditions, the race believes more in good than evil, otherwise it would not continue to exist. This is the eternal hope and sense of our life. Okay, so then, does anybody have any questions or thoughts about practitioner or treatment or anything?
I do.
What?
I love study group.
Oh, well, that's good.
So, what helped me with the segment on holding a thought, like trying to force something as opposed to realizing the truth and allowing it to be. So only someone who's seen this movie will get the reference, but in The Matrix, there's a scene where they say, don't try to bend the spoon. Try to realize there is no spoon. And it bends itself when you have the realization. So that helped me process those two different ways of going at it with what you were saying there.
All right. The Matrix was a terribly wonderful spiritual movie. I think. Yeah.
Is it terrible or no. Wonderful?
Terribly wonderful. How's that?
I still don't understand.
It's a conundrum.
Don't know what conundrum means.
It's confusing on purpose.
And we, watching The Yellow Submarine last night, heard many times, it's all in the mind. It's all in the mind.
Okay, well, so now we're moving on to...
Breakdown yet?
I'm sorry, we're moving on to the second part of this chapter, which is completely different than the first part, which is a history of the new thought and the development of a religious science. And fascinating, really. Fascinating. Nothing I didn't already know, but everything I didn't already know. You know, I mean, in the sense that, well, he goes through the influence. He starts with the influence of the influences that created the New Thought movement. And first, the first influence is Indian, the Indian Hinduism. And while New Thought actually originated in the United States, it has its roots in many, many, many ancient traditions and conditions. And the first is the Hindu tradition, it's not really Hinduism, it's more Advaita Vedanta. The ancient teachings of the Bhagavad Gita, the Upanishads, and the Vedas. You will find one volume of this is a book that he recommends to explain it all, which I've never heard of. It's called Life Divine by Aurobindo. Anyway, so the philosophy, looking over these generations of teachings, we find very great concept of unity of all life. They believed in one God and only one. They didn't call it God, they called it the Absolute or Brahma, but it doesn't matter what you call it. They believed in one presence, one power, and only one in the universe. They believed in the mind that sleeps in the minerals, waves, in the grass, the mind that sleeps in the minerals, waves in the grass, wakes to simple consciousness in the animal and to self-consciousness in the human, and cosmic consciousness in what they call the upper hierarchies, or the ascending scale of evolution, ad infinitum. They believed in the theory of involution and evolution, the spark that ignites the mundane clod, or the divine idea which exists in everything, a something that all things are impregnated with. It is called involution in the passing of the spirit into the substance prior to passing of substance into definite form, or being an endless round of evolution, or unfoldment, cycle after cycle. Over and over, until they have learned what there is here, and then on and on and on. So the initial New Thought movement began as a wedding of the Eastern philosophy with the Western philosophy. And to some degree, after the Indian, which is the most ancient tradition, came the Greeks. And the philosophy of Christianity is a combination of what is called Palestinian impositionalism, which means, thus said the God from up here, and what is called the Grecian immanentism, which is the God from in here, which is such a great concept. I mean, it's so clear. God up here, God in here. And a combination of the two is what Christianity was teaching, or what Christ was teaching. And it says, and the ancient Hebrews, and still today they haven't changed their doctrine, and the ancient Hindus, they haven't changed either. We're together with the certain phrases of ancient Egypt, which I wish to mention, the first people to perceive unitary cause. Whatever it is, it's one, it is one, and not two ultimates. The truth is one, undivided and indivisible. Okay, we find in the Greeks a rehearsal of the Hermetic teachings. Now, this is another great influence of the New Thought movement, which was 1,500 years prior to the time of Moses. We find the Hermetic doctrine, Hermes. In this teaching, we find a great deal that Moses taught. Because Moses was educated in the Egyptian court, in the Egyptian temples, he was brought up by the Egyptian priests, the hierarchy of nobility. He was a top guy, as history has shown. We find in the Greeks a rehearsal of the Hermetic teaching, particularly in their concept of what Emerson called the law of parallels and Swedenborg called the law of correspondences. Because the Hermetic teaching had said, as above, so beneath, as beneath, so above. This is what is true on one plane is true on all, which really means, and this is where we got the idea, that for every visible thing, there is an invisible pattern to which the visible is attached.
We don't have much more time.
Okay.
So we need to wrap it up.
Okay.
Because it's already after 12 o'clock.
Okay. Well, so bottom line, I will just skip to the last. Bottom line is that the history of New Thought movement and the history of religious science is just fascinating. But I do want to end with this. Faith is an attitude of mind accepted and no longer rejected. We have to have the same faith in what we teach and preach and practice that science has or the gardener has. And when the terrific and great simplicity shall have plumbed and penetrated this destiny of ours, this human stolidness and stupidity, this blindness which we seem to be born with, this drunkenness, this duplicity of intellect and the soul, then something new and wonderful will happen. It is the only thing that will keep the world from destroying itself. And then if you ever get to that place of stillness, out of everything it comes, the uncertainty, the creativity, the creative possibility, the individual out of uncreated, the voice that is not spoken yet is ready to articulate something new and fresh, a creation that never existed and never again and need never again be. But it is passing in movements of our present fantasy. The world shall become flesh. The word shall become flesh and dwell among us as long as it ought to and dissolve when it is no longer necessary. You and I as practitioners can throw all of our theories and all of our books and all of our previous prayers out the window now because they are evermore about it and about it and about it. They are necessary. Emerson said that when it happens, throw out all your theories, leave them all as Joseph left his coat in the hands of the harlot, and flee, for it is it's a transcendent moment. This is the moment of a new creation. And so it is.
So it is.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you.